Welcome back to the Her Earth Medicine podcast. Today I have the pleasure of interviewing Stephen Judge, who is a naturopath based in Sydney, Australia. Stephen is a wealth of knowledge in the area of histamine, so let's dive in and talk all things histamine with Stephen Judge. Stephen, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became a specialist in this area?
Yeah, so long story short, like many other colleagues, essentially had multiple health challenges of my own and, you know, engaged the conventional medical system, but wasn't really sold on the solutions that were offered. And I'd had like zero idea or knowledge of what else was available, but intuitively I just thought, oh, it's got to be more to it than that. So yeah, I just kind of went down a rabbit hole of research and got really fascinated by nutritional biochemistry, and that was kind of my gateway into the naturopathic world. Like when I enrolled into college, it was for nutrition. Like I couldn't have told you what a naturopath was. But as I didn't even realize I was getting into nutritional medicine from a naturopathic perspective. I just looked at the curriculum and thought, oh, that sounds great. So I enrolled into that college, and yeah, a few years into it, learned more about the, you know, naturopathic philosophy and what is involved in that and what naturopaths are. And I just got the bug essentially and kept studying and needed herbal medicine in my practice and just wanted to learn more. So got into practice slowly over the years. I was personally always interested in gut and mental health and the gut-brain axis and that link. And I fell into the histamine intolerance thing pretty much by accident. Like it wasn't something I learned much about at university, maybe very briefly for an hour or two it was touched on as like, you know, a food intolerance, but we didn't go into it that deeply. So over the years as I started working with more and more people and particularly seeing people with like chronic issues, particularly in the realms of like autoimmunity, and stealth infections and endometriosis and all these kind of things, and people with chronic gut issues, you know, there was this subset of people, a large subset of people who were doing all the right things on paper with their diet, so to speak, and even people doing gut microbiome protocols and all this kind of thing, but they were still really unwell with a very specific set of symptoms. And it was just kind of a mystery to me until I can't even remember how I stumbled across the phenomenon of histamine intolerance. I think I read some sort of study, 2007 study, which I'll talk about in this podcast. I'm highlighting what histamine intolerance is. And, you know, I put my first ever client on a low histamine diet just to see how they responded. And, you know, it quote unquote changed their life. All their symptoms went away. And yeah, so then I started seeing it everywhere in people with IBS, with SIBO, with endometriosis, and all these different things. And so I pay a lot more attention to it now. I try not to get too stuck in a vacuum with it. Like not everyone has it, but I do, I guess because my client base is heavily focused around gut microbiome health and SIBO and all these things. So many of them have histamine intolerance. And it's just something doctors don't look at, a lot of dietitians aren't looking at, a lot of practitioners aren't looking at. And it can be a really key thing to get people really rapid symptom relief after a long time of being quite sick, if it is their issue, and then also gives them a path to really figure out the deeper issue of what causes histamine intolerance. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, I think it wasn't probably until halfway through my, I mean, maybe 4 or 5 years into studying, or sorry, working as a practitioner that I came across histamine issues myself. Obviously, same histamine reactions and skin stuff. We hear about it in college. But I think it was when I went into methylation, and I had definitely been doing a lot of gut stuff and I never really had the links there. And then once you start going into methylation, and then you definitely can't unsee it once you go down that histamine pathway. There are so many conditions that do link with it. And the gut, there's a massive role there with those microbiomes and those histamine-producing bugs. And, yeah, it's such an interesting topic. So really, I think there's going to be a fascinating conversation. So let's start off by talking about like the role that histamine actually plays in the body and what is our histamine intolerance?
Yeah, so histamine is a biogenic amine. Okay, so biogenic basically alluding to the fact that it's a substance produced by all living organisms, right? So bacteria produce it, mold produce it, yeast, animals, plants, and humans. Within humans, it's essentially this signaling molecule with multiple functions. It is not just a mediator of the allergic response, which is what we typically associate histamine with when we hear the word, right? Like allergies and antihistamine. But outside of its role in mediating the allergic response, it's involved with so many other things. Like it's involved with neurotransmission and the sleep-wake cycle and mood, because it's actually a neurotransmitter. It's a modulator of the immune response and inflammation. It regulates gut function, like it influences gut motility, and it also regulates gastric acid secretion. It's a vasodilator, so it constricts bronchial smooth muscle and uterine smooth muscle. It obviously secretes mucus, and it has a special relationship in interacting with and increasing and liberating the production of estrogen. So it's incredible how many roles it plays in the body, which is because there are different types of histamine receptors in the body. It in effect influences 8 different organ systems, just depending on where it's being released and which receptor it's attaching itself to. So that is, you know, what's going on with histamine. Histamine intolerance is essentially what develops when too much histamine accumulates in the body, which we can really boil down to being a result of impaired detoxification, which is one of these core principles of naturopathic philosophy, like regardless of what we're treating. So optimizing all facets of detoxification pathways in the body is of extreme importance. You know, like all other active substances in the body, we have to be able to deactivate it and get it out. So the issues come when detoxification of this substance is impaired. So right here from the outset, you know, it's important to remember that histamine is not the enemy, so to speak. You know, it's not something we need to quote unquote fight. So it's all organisms make it for a very specific reason. It's actually really important for us to make histamine. It's really just a symptom of a deeper problem. We just need to bring balance to it, essentially.
Okay, so maybe we can dive into some of those systems that it does work on in the body. So, like, for example, I love the association and people really connect when you talk about the stomach acid and histamine. So could we maybe go into what systems it affects and what are some of those symptoms that someone might manifest as a result of being histamine intolerant?
Yes, so there is a very long list of potential symptoms.
Pick your favourite.
when someone is histamine intolerant, but you don't have to have all of them to experience them, you know. So I've met people who've got one or two of them only, but are very strong and predominant, like unexplained chronic nausea and vertigo, for example. Or they might have quite a lot, okay, which I'll lay out for us now. So, you know, it affects obviously the respiratory system. So it can manifest as what appears to be allergic symptoms, right? So congestion, sneezing, runny nose, you know, all those allergic type symptoms. And due to its effect on bronchoconstriction, it can drive a lot of asthmatic symptoms as well, like shortness of breath and wheezing. It affects the female reproductive system in two specific ways. So it stimulates smooth muscle contraction. So it manifests as pelvic pain and dysmenorrhea, period pain in women is a key symptom. And the second way it affects the female repro system is that it directly stimulates the ovaries to produce more estrogen. This is why histamine intolerance is directly linked with everything and anything that's related to having relative estrogen excess presentation. So chronic period pain, menorrhagia, heavy periods, PMS symptoms. It's very common, if not always present, in endometriosis as well. So key clues of histamine intolerance in women are if they are experiencing symptoms like clockwork around ovulation and or premenstrually, just because these are the times of the menstrual cycle where estrogen is relatively higher than progesterone. So there's that potential for high histamine around those times of the cycle if estrogen and histamine aren't being detoxified optimally. So this is where, like, you know, premenstrual migraines and anxiety and nausea and insomnia are kind of classic clues for histamine intolerance. It affects the gut, okay? So again, smooth muscle contraction. So it can cause a lot of chronic diarrhea, abdominal pain and cramping. And as you mentioned before, it increases gastric acid secretion. So hydrochloric acid. So one of the hallmark signs of histamine intolerance I see in a clinic is chronic reflux and heartburn, GORD. It's pretty rare someone doesn't improve looking at the histamine angle if that's going on. It affects the central nervous system. So this is where we see its role as a neurotransmitter come in. If in excess, it's directly linked with chronic and recurrent migraines and headaches. Migraines is a big one. It's pretty rare I meet anyone with chronic recurrent migraines who doesn't need to address histamine intolerance. It's at least one part of it, especially with women if it's premenstrual. Unexplained vertigo, nausea, dizziness, vomiting is a big clue there as well for this impaired neurotransmitter histamine handling. And excessive histamine in the central nervous system also equals anxiety, insomnia, depression, right? But that's one part of it. It affects the cardiovascular system. It can cause low blood pressure. So this is very common in people with, like, POTS presentations as well, having palpitations and arrhythmias. It can contribute to hypertension as well, but the low blood pressure is, like, a big clue, especially if you start to see a lot of the other histamine symptoms. It affects the skin. These people are getting recurrent hives and, you know, flushing and rosacea and eczema. It affects the musculoskeletal system. It manifests as kind of recurrent joint pains, inflammation. Histamine plays a role in regulating pain sensation. It obviously affects the immune system, right? It's released as part of the body's inflammatory response. So there's all these kind of key symptoms that are associated with, you know, redness, inflammation, pain, excessive stimulation, like with the nervous system, gut symptoms, particularly around reflux and heartburn, and anything to do with, you know, relative estrogen excess presentations. Not body system so much, but I'll also just highlight that it's pretty common in autoimmune diseases for histamine intolerance to be at play, particularly if there are gut issues going on. You know, like, I see it all the time in Hashimoto's thyroiditis, for example. These people have heaps of symptoms, but pretty chronic gut issues and rosacea and all these different things. And again, they may come to me and they're already trying to, you know, they're following a paleo diet and they're already gluten, dairy-free and doing all these things they should be doing, but they're still really unwell. And if I look at their diet sometimes, you know, there's heaps of sauerkraut and avocado and all these wonderful foods that are unfortunately loaded with histamine. And also a whole other rabbit hole we could go down, but I think you recently interviewed someone on SIRS and mold biotoxin illness, but because of this pretty intense degree of immune dysregulation in these people who are experiencing SIRS, histamine intolerance is without a doubt, unfortunately, happening in this population as well.
Yeah, very interesting with that link there. And I think we're going to see a lot of it more surface, a lot of it surface again with all the recent flooding we've had all through Southeast Queensland, Northern Rivers, and I know down in Sydney. So there's so many conditions and symptoms that you've just listed then. A lot of people will be going, oh, wow, like, how does this happen? What is the driver to someone developing a histamine intolerance? What are we all doing wrong? Can you break it down a little bit for us? What's the causation to many of these issues?
Yeah, so, you know, a key clue to think about it, like I was saying before, is it essentially is a result of impaired detoxification, right? So there is two main systems of detoxification of histamine in the body. So, and it comes down to two main categories. So we have endogenous histamine, so histamine we create internally and should get rid of naturally, and then we have exogenous or externally sourced histamine, which are coming into the body that we need to get rid of, which are predominantly food sources. So the endogenous histamine we create internally is naturally synthesized within our cells from histidine, an amino acid which is converted into histamine, okay? And the endogenous histamine that we're making all the time essentially should be detoxified by the enzyme HNMT, so histamine N-methyltransferase, okay, which is responsible for degrading histamine out of the body using our major methyl donor, SAMe, okay? So there is a need to consider, and most people with histamine issues then need to correct and support any issues surrounding methylation, particularly if they are experiencing, you know, the nervous system symptoms of excessive histamine, so heightened anxiety and insomnia and hypervigilance and stuff like that. So methylation is a big one. So, you know, HNMT, this enzyme, is highly concentrated in the liver. So we need, you know, we need sufficient SAMe and its cofactors like the B6, B12, folate, okay? And obviously looking at anything that affects methylation, okay? So chronic inflammation, smoking, poor sleep, heavy metals, etc., okay? But we need to look at methylation to support this endogenous histamine. Then we have the exogenous histamine, so the histamine we're exposed to externally, namely from food. So this, the way we detoxify this histamine coming in through the gut is via an enzyme called diamine oxidase, or DAO for short. This DAO enzyme is found throughout the body, but it's particularly concentrated in the epithelial lining of the gut, particularly the small intestine, okay? So we should be constantly secreting DAO enzyme in the lining of the gut wall so we can get histamine out. But our ability to create the DAO enzyme can be compromised due to things like gut dysbiosis in the large intestine or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Particularly if we have a high degree of SIBO, a lot of this is coming down to intestinal hyperpermeability, aka leaky gut. So in terms of addressing histamine intolerance, yes, we do need to look at methylation, but of more importance, just as, you know, equal importance, it's really coming down to the gut. So we need to look at leaky gut. We need to look at small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We need to look at large intestinal dysbiosis and anything and everything that is affecting those things, right? So for someone else, it could be chronic stress, it could be mold, right? It could be certain medications. Like, we need to take a step back and just look at the individual and address everything that could be affecting their gut health, essentially.
And how are you differentiating between endogenous and exogenous histamine? Are you going off the genetic SNPs or the signs and symptoms that person's presenting with? What are you using to get a clear picture?
Yeah, look, in terms of when I first meet them, predominantly symptoms, mm-hmm. Okay? So, you know, as I mentioned, the gut issues with histamine relate to things coming in from the outside, and, you know, I'm looking at if people have chronic reflux and bloating and pain and, you know, all these different things, right? These people usually have SIBO going on. In terms of the brain histamine, just think, remembering that it's an excitatory neurotransmitter. So similar to glutamate. So it's meant to make us feel awake and arouse us. And, you know, it's why we hear people, improving their sleep if they take an antihistamine, right? So in terms of, let's say, testing, look, it is possible to have gene variants and genetic mutations, okay, where the HNMT enzyme doesn't function optimally, okay? And it's also possible to have a Dow enzyme genetic mutation, which, you know, that person will be more susceptible to having poor clearance of histamine. Despite the genetics involved, I encourage most of my client base, regardless of what I'm treating them for, and in the context of histamine intolerance, I encourage my clients not to get too obsessed on the genes, okay? Because like anything, we all have our genetic susceptibilities and predispositions, right, to things we would be susceptible to manifesting, illness and disease-wise. But regardless of whether or not someone goes off and tests whether or not they have these two genes, if they have histamine intolerance still, like, it doesn't change the direction of treatment. Okay, so I'm not a fan of, and I'm encouraging as many people as possible these days to kind of get their head out of this gene-based determinism kind of perspective, because it's really disempowering and it can essentially get people stuck in this mindset of, oh shit, like, you know, this is why I'm histamine intolerant and this is how it's always going to be. But it's too much of a reductionist kind of view on it. We have to think about histamine intolerance as being a symptom of a deeper problem. The deeper problem really coming down to intestinal hyperpermeability, leaky gut, large intestinal dysbiosis, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and anything and everything that can contribute to those things. So we have to zoom out and really focus on the whole person and what is going on with them in those areas. And so in terms of, testing, you've almost got to think about histamine intolerance. Again, it's more like a syndrome. This is not like a condition that exists in isolation. It's almost like a diagnosis of exclusion kind of situation as well. If someone's presenting to you with all these symptoms, you have to run all the, you know, usual blood work we would run and make sure they don't have true allergies and test them and see if they've got autoimmune diseases going on. But you essentially have to get all the proper blood work done we would usually test for. And then with testing, look, there are tests, like you can test for histamine metabolites, like in the urine, you can look at Dow enzyme in the bloodstream. You can do a whole blood histamine test, but the reality with those tests is they're not very reliable to confirm or deny the existence of histamine intolerance. So my clients say, look, you're welcome to test all that if you want, but if you want to save some time and money, again, they're not going to help direct my treatment. I'd rather you cut to the chase, get all the right blood work done, and just invest testing that's looking more at microbiome, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and leaky gut, because that's what we really need to fix, at least to begin with. Only caveat to that approach, I would say, is if people are presenting with Sears, mold, biotoxin illness, stealth infections, it's not that simple. I wouldn't be putting them straight on some hectic gut protocol. I'd really need to be sussing out if Sears is their thing and look into their home environment and sort that out first and, you know, quell the kind of chronic inflammatory load before putting them on any sort of strong gut protocols.
Hey guys, just a quick plug in to let you know that my online children's health course, Wild Bloom, is now available. This is all things naturopathic and Chinese medicine for raising children naturally. Learn about postnatal health, breastfeeding, starting solids, gut health for children, nutrition for children, Chinese medicine for children, and what you can use for common ailments. Use the code BLOOM for $50 off, available at herearthmedicine.com. Can I ask, Stephen, could you maybe take us back a little bit? You've mentioned about the importance of the gut and leaky gut and how that will help so many of the symptoms related to histamine or high histamine. Could you maybe take it back to where you mentioned the other factors, which are detoxification and how methylation fits into that, or just maybe explain a little bit about what methylation actually is in the body?
Yeah, sure. So methylation is it's a biochemical process that should be happening, is happening in every cell of our body, okay? And it has many different functions. So it's very, in the context of what we're talking about, methylation is, one of its major roles is in with detoxification of substances, primarily in the liver, okay? And it's involved with many other things like genetic expression. So it's involved with how our genes get expressed and turn on and off, so which is very important. And it's has a role with cell division and cell renewal and things like that. There's many different important roles. And the context of what we're talking about with liver detoxification, so there are many different types of liver detoxification pathways. But methylation is one of its major roles is to clear and detoxify estrogen and histamine, okay, which we've talked about are linked. So if one of those are high, they cause each other to be high. So we need to make sure estrogen and histamine are being detoxified as adequately as possible. So there are two enzymes in the body that are essential for methylation to function properly. So one I mentioned before was the HNMT enzyme, so histamine and methyltransferase, which breaks down histamine. Also involved with methylation is an enzyme called COMT, which practitioners will know is very important for detoxifying estrogen in the liver. So with supporting methylation, we really need to make sure we are in the diet, but also supplements can help, particularly at the beginning stages and people are quite unwell, getting all the proper forms of activated B vitamins to support that cycle. So it requires very specific forms of B vitamins, particularly like B6, 9 and 12. Working with someone's important though, because depending on what's going on with that person, some of those types of B vitamins can make a lot of people worse if they're like, they can be way too strong. So not as simple as cool, go take the Bs. You may need to work on a few other things like the gut and heavy metals before going there. But yeah, so with methylation, you know, it has been popular in the past for to test for whole blood histamine in the blood test to determine if someone is kind of like under methylating or if they're methylating too quickly. These days, that's a bit too simple, in my opinion, not just mine, but it's a bit too simplistic an idea to say, you know, high histamine means you're an under methylator and low histamine means you're an over-methylator. Like, it's just too simplistic. This idea was presented by Carl Pfeiffer and Abram Hoffer. So these are the two biochemists, and one of them was a psychiatrist, who put forth this idea of having too much or too little histamine could be related to having psychiatric symptoms. And to their credit, you know, that has actually turned out to be very true. But in terms of relying on whole blood histamine to test for methylation, it's really inadequate. In terms of the, like, the blood levels, it has a very short half-life. And, you know, someone could have great methylation status. You know, they could have plenty of SAMe and the HNMT enzymes working properly. I won't get too deep into it, but someone could have poor enzyme function of something called monoamine oxidase, which causes the HNMT enzyme to back up. And so regardless of, you know, someone could essentially have really good methylation, but they've got high histamine levels due to other enzymes going on. So my point being that the whole blood histamine test isn't that useful, in my opinion, or reliable for telling someone what's going on with their methylation. You can do something called a methylation profile, like test, which looks at the ratio of something called SAMe to SAR, and it looks at other metabolites and types of folate. But yeah, look, again, as long as we begin, it's even though the gut and brain histamine are these separate entities, I think I can think of two clients off the top of my head ever who had no gut issues, and we didn't treat the gut, and I just looked at their methylation and their brain histamine symptoms resolved. Like, it's pretty rare. So the methylation piece is important, but I would still make sure to begin with, you know, because I'm also taking into account here costs, right? There's so many different things you can spend money on with testing. I would still start with the gut and all these foundational lifestyle strategies we need to, you know, get people onto in small steps in terms of getting their diet right and getting their sleep right is huge. And treating the gut, and then if people want to look at methylation testing and stuff, they can. But it wouldn't be like a huge priority for me to begin with and how I practice anyway. And again, you can do a lot of genetic testing around methylation. So, and obviously MTHFR, but there are so many other more genes involved. So again, the genes are interesting. It is nice to know what you're susceptible to, but I wouldn't get too hyper-focused on the genes and letting the gene test determine what your treatment will be. That's where a lot of people it can all go very wrong, because they haven't, you know, the genes are there, but it's not telling you kind of what's out of balance, so to speak.
So true. So many patients come in with a blood test where they've done the MTHFR gene and they're either heterozygous or homozygous, and they're like, that's it, that's the cause of all my problems. It's methylation. And it's just one gene. There's so many, as you said, other genes involved in that methylation profile, working out whether you're under or over methylator, and also differentiating whether you have low versus high histamine. So could we maybe touch on some of those presentations for low versus high histamine?
Yeah, sure. So the high histamine folk, all those symptoms I mentioned before, with all those different body systems, right? So in the gut, it's pretty chronic reflux. Some people get a lot of nausea. They've got all the bloating and cramping and irregular bowels and that type of thing. In terms of the nervous system side of things, these people are generally, in terms of high histamine, it's someone is very prone to heightened anxiety, due to its effect on the stress response. People with high levels of brain histamine tend to have very reduced appetite, especially in the morning, and they can be prone to like a bit of morning nausea, okay? So this is where we're getting into like, you know, pyrrole's territory as well, right? A lot of the symptoms overlap here with high histamine and pyrrole's. So they also, high histamine people also tend to be quite slim and heat intolerant or heat sensitive. They tend to have poor sleep, right? So it really affects the sleep-wake cycle. People with high levels of histamine, like brain histamine, you know, they are easily agitated. They find it hard to relax. There's some kind of potential personality traits, which is really interesting. And this is, you know, looking at Hoffer and Pfeiffer's work with pyrroles and histamine, but they can have this like hyper attention to detail, kind of perfectionistic kind of personality. Their histamine is involved with motivation in the nervous system. So these are people who are perfectionistic, super motivated, high achieving. But if that goes on for too long, those people can burn out, okay, and start to lose that motivation. But if that's been someone's temperament, like kind of lifelong temperament, you could argue that they've probably got a bit of, you know, could work on their histamine clearance. And another high histamine clue is this, like, susceptibility people have to motion sickness. Okay, because when our visual and sensory input system are experiencing, like, say, a conflict, like their body is in motion, but the eyes can't see where it's going, this triggers histamine release. You know, the histamine lands on this H1 receptor, which is responsible for controlling the emetic or vomit response. So, you know, I've had people in clinic who, again, they may not have tick every histamine box, but they've got this, like, unexplained nausea and susceptibility to motion sickness and vertigo. And I'll say to some people, look, as an experiment, just so we know we might be on the right track, just go grab an over-the-counter antihistamine, see if it gets rid of the nausea.
Mm.
And
oh,
it usually does. And that's, you know, from the client's experience, and they're kind of really on board and like, oh, cool, like we found something that's going on. Yeah, so that's like a little clue as well. In terms of low histamine, this predominantly manifests as like central nervous system symptoms. So I know most of this talk, and when people are talking about histamine intolerance, they tend to be focused on having too much histamine, but you can have very low levels of histamine, which you could argue, you know, in some ways manifests as the opposite of our histamine person. So they're very prone to poor cognitive function, they're brain fogged, they've got, you know, in terms of learning and memory, they're really struggling, they find it hard to concentrate, they tend to have very reduced motivation and drive in general, they have very low libido, which has been high histamine people tend to have a very strong libido, they have very increased appetite, you know, they've massively increased desire for food, they don't really have issues with sleep, but they can be very, you know, they're people who can get quite a lot of sleep and don't have issues falling asleep, but they're pretty exhausted and flat despite that. And in terms of, there is some evidence looking at people with very low histamine that it does drive depression. This has been observed by people experiencing depression at very low levels of like histamine 1 receptors in the central nervous system, which could also be explained by the fact that if you have low histamine, it essentially means you have low serotonin. There's this relationship between low histamine and low serotonin. Yeah, they're the main ones.
Okay, cool, yeah. I love the explanation. It really gives you a personality typing to kind of fit to the picture too. And, you know, often it is the case, someone might not fit all those, you know, they might not be slim and tall or whatever with high histamine, but they might have all those other symptoms. So it's really good to give people the identity to kind of go, okay, this is potentially you and this is potentially you. So I love that explanation. Could we maybe look into some more, you know, pathology testing or what kind of testing people can look for if they're considering that there is a potential histamine intolerance, whether it's high or low? Where do you start? Because I know bloods are a great one and you've already talked a little bit about SNPs, and it sounds like to me SNPs are not your priority with testing. So I'd love to hear, where do you start with testing for histamine issues?
Yes, so when I meet people, regardless of what's going on, but particularly, you know, definitely histamine intolerance, I need the comprehensive blood work, like you just said. So full blood counts, liver markers, and, you know, active and regular B12 and folate and thyroid function, like all the things, okay? I would also whack on there, I do want to look at the zinc copper profiles as well. So plasma zinc, serum copper, ceruloplasmin with blood testing, because zinc and copper and B6, zinc and B6 tend to be very common treatments with pyrroles and histamine issues. Zinc and B6 are nutritional cofactors that are necessary for a lot of the enzymes involved in histamine metabolism. As we know, zinc and B6 are important for, you know, a thousand other things. But I want to get a proper zinc copper profile to know what's going on there, because some people I do need have very low copper after smashing the zinc for too long. Outside of all that, I'm usually encouraging people to go straight to the gut Okay, so I personally rely, at least to begin with, a lot more on gut microbiome testing with my clients to begin with, rather than SIBO testing. My reasons for that being that, you know, the microbiome test, it gives us a lot more information, you know, in terms of what could be going on in the gut relative to a SIBO test. And in how I treat the gut anyway, the treatments are almost identical. So I say to people, look, you can test SIBO as well if you want straight away. But if you want to save some time and money, just start with the microbiome and we'll go from there. Okay. And yeah, you know, with the microbiome testing, the one I use anyway, I'm very interested in if people have high levels of something we can test for on a microbiome test called beta-glucuronidase.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another element of the whole detoxification component of all this. The glucuronidation is a phase two liver detoxification pathway. But if people develop large intestinal dysbiosis, that's the potential for certain types of bacteria to create very high amounts of something, an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And essentially, if that's going on in the gut, which microbiome testing can pick up, rather than the bowels getting estrogen out, it causes reabsorption of estrogen back into circulation in this like ongoing cycle. So I see that a lot of microbiome testing. It's like, cool, so we know if you have too much estrogen, it's going to increase your histamine. And if we do microbiome testing, I'm saying to a lot of my clients, well, look, it's great that you're supporting your liver and your methylation and taking broccoli sprout and whatever else they're doing for their liver, but it's being reabsorbed in the gut chronically, constantly. So again, that's why I kind of prefer microbiome testing to begin with. It gives us all these other clues and there's very specific treatments for that. Outside of, and, you know, depending on how people respond to treatment, we may check SIBO and check that it's gone, essentially. Only in people who are still kind of experiencing ongoing symptoms to some degree. If people get better, like, I mean, that was the end goal anyway, we just don't even bother. Outside of the gut and the bloods, I will, like I said before, important caveat to all this is if someone is presenting with many symptoms of what appears to be serious or mold biotoxin illness, we kind of have to look at that first. That's crucial. But outside of that, I will also look at things like hair tissue mineral analysis and get their mineral status correct, and also deal with any toxic heavy metals that are impacting mineral absorption and putting a load on detoxification. They're the key ones I do in clinic. Look, Dutch testing is very popular as well. It's like a kind of the, you know, fanciest, most comprehensive kind of hormone metabolite profile out there to my knowledge. And it's a great test. But again, I would still kind of prioritize the gut first and get all the foundational things right. If people are still kind of hypersensitive in some sort of way, we'll go there then. But yeah, that's kind of my approach.
No, I love that. I love the priority of the testing too. The gut microbiome is so important, as you said. I think definitely over the SIBO testing where, you know, we might find high methane or whatever we're looking for in the SIBO, but that's all the information we get for whatever they spend on it versus the microbiome can tell us so much. And there's even the bacteria that we can see, for example, like Klebsiella that produce histamine. So there's just
a wealth
of knowledge. Yeah, that's it. So much better to go into the gut. I'm a big fan of gut testing. And bloods, certainly love doing bloods. And I use the hair tissue testing probably in the last order like you do as well, because I feel like once you support the gut, then you can get an idea on mineral absorption and heavy metal clearance, because you're not going to really do that until you don't have a leaky gut anyway. Can we maybe go back to bloods for a second? I would just love to hear a little bit more on the copper studies there a little bit with the zinc levels, copper and ceruloplasmin.
Yeah. So this is kind of touching on Pyrrhal's territory, I guess. With zinc and copper, like, so with Pyrrhal's, for a sec, like, there is a urine test you can do to, you know, determine whether or not you have Pyrrhal's disorder. But I rarely use that anymore in clinic just because it's not so reliable. Not only that, but again, like any test anyone ever offers you, or, you know, if a practitioner wants to, you only really want to do it if it's actually going to direct the treatment in a specific way. So the urine test, it's like, cool, but like, what do I do about it? Yeah. So it's like, at the end of the day, we need the zinc, copper and ceruloplasmin on the bloods as a part of how we're going to treat this. So the zinc and copper, plasma zinc and serum copper are what I would test for. They're not really useful as markers on their own, like, you know, being within a certain reference range. It's more useful having plasma and zinc alongside ceruloplasmin, which is the body's major copper transport protein in the body. And with those three markers, we can figure out the ratio of the zinc and copper to each other and how much of the copper is bound and unbound in the bloodstream. And if you've got very high levels of unbound copper, that can cause a lot of issues with inflammation and suboptimal zinc status and stuff like that. And ideally, if we're getting into zinc and copper territory, we do a hair tissue mineral analysis as well, to see how all the other minerals are being handled around that, because again, zinc and copper aren't just kind of working in isolation. It's so connected with other minerals.
Yeah, thank you for elaborating on that. And more in clinic, and you probably may notice it too, and I'm sure other prackies are, is the connection with those guys and everyone being so iron deficient, and everyone's taking iron, and then you've got this ceruloplasma issue. So I think it's really important for people to get a perspective on the bloods from someone who really understands what they mean in the ratios, not just isolating those individual tests. So yeah, thank you for touching on that.
That's good.
Okay, so I feel like we've covered quite a bit on histamine. You've covered so much from, you know, the internal externals, the gut-brain differences between the histamine levels we have there. We've covered SNPs. Is there anything else that you think is important for our listeners to gather around histamine and histamine intolerances?
Anyone kind of, you know, hears this or reads something and thinks, wow, I think I have a histamine intolerance, you know, essentially the first step is to figure this out. Like, yes, there's all this testing to look into deeper issues, but like, if in doubt, the first most definitive way to figure out if this is an issue for you is to look up the low histamine diet and do it as best as you can for 2 to 4 weeks. Okay. If you are histamine intolerant, your symptoms will reduce, even if it's just subtle, but most people, I mean, it's significant, right? If they follow it properly. You know, just quickly, I think I haven't talked about this, but, you know, high histamine, there's a lot of information if people want to Google it, but, high histamine foods and any food that's aged, fermented, or ripened. So, you know, when people have never heard of this and I show them the list, they're like, holy shit, that's my whole diet.
Yeah, they all say that. Oh no, avocado.
Avocado every day. Yep. And I eat avocado every day and I thought spinach was good for me and I'm having raw fermented dairy. And I'm like, yeah, look, that is all really great, but you're going to need to have a short break while this issue is going on, unfortunately. But go on a low histamine diet, see how you feel. However, it's important to understand that you cannot stay on a low histamine diet forever, and if you do, that is just going to cause a whole other range of problems down the track. So you've got to come at it, like, ready to really look at the deeper problem as well, because that's another issue. Like, I meet people in clinic who've never heard of it, and I'm bringing it to their attention for the first time. On the flip hand, I have people coming in who've been on it for like 5 years. And because of other issues going on with their health, they've become really scared to reintroduce food, and it's almost like they've become more reactive to food. So you don't want to get stuck in that. Is a very hard place to get out of. So essentially, if you think you've got the issue, and you know, try low histamine diet, see how you feel. Like, most people notice it very obviously within 2 to 4 weeks, but also just be aware that you've really got to work with someone to work out the deeper reasons as to why you are histamine intolerant. For most people, it's a degree of gut involvement, which is where I generally start. For others, there could be like a mold stealth infection issue as well. So just, you know, always working with someone to help you navigate that, because it can get a bit complex. And also, again, just don't hyper focus about genes and like, okay, this is the deal for the rest of my life. Like, whether it's conscious or intentional or not, I think people can get a bit hyper focused and obsessed about all that and neglect the things that involve like the everyday choices and self-care rituals we make or should be making, which really have a much bigger impact on getting over this stuff long term than like the supplements and the whatever. So, you know, the sleep, circadian rhythm regulation, you know, anything related to healing our nervous system, diet, movement, you know, we really, I guess the journey, I'm viewing a lot of my clients, the journey of them, you know, uncovering they've got histamine intolerance, to really get over that, it really does require, like, it's a gateway into really needing to look at all aspects of their life and you know, step by step with some guidance and help and encouragement and compassion, help them start to really move through that. It's not this thing which can be fixed by a supplement or one protocol, so to speak. It's really a gateway into reviewing like their entire, you know, lifestyle and everything going on with their health. Mm. That's kind of what I'm observing anyway, just because it's a very particular phenomenon.
Yeah, very holistic approach. Yeah, I love that. We take it into all the aspects, mind, body, physical aspects, environment, lifestyle, diet, you know, are you emotionally expressing things? It's so important to really get people to understand it's not just removing histamine from the diet, but like you said, there's so many pathways that lead into it. So well said.
Yeah, I'm particularly going down massive rabbit hole at the moment with anything and everything to do with circadian rhythm. Like, wow, man, like if people could get the circadian rhythm regulated and their sleep right and eating and moving at the right times, like they could shift their entire health status. Like it's quite fascinating. So I'd also just, interesting side point, like, you know, get onto really, and I'm trying to get this into my clients a lot these days as well, like really make regulating your sleep-wake cycle and circadian rhythm, try to make that, it's a practice, but try to make it a big priority. Mm. Like that could just radically shift a lot of what's going on for you.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Waking up with natural light, blue light blockers if needed, getting off our screens, going back to reading hard books. Checking in on sleep hygiene. Yes, so important. And that's the thing, I guess, the role as a naturopath is you zone in on the importance of what the things are we need to do, and then we zone out on the bigger picture of, you know, this is your maintenance for the rest of your life. These are the things you want to look at and integrate it all.
I hand up guilty, definitely, like many years ago. When I first, it's like anything, like when I first discovered what pyrrols was and histamine, and I thought, oh my God, this is the thing. This is the one thing. It's like the cause of everyone's problems. And got a little bit too zoned in on it. So I can relate to clients to where that happens. It's like, I did that as a practitioner. You know, and I guess really trying to, truth seekers and people trying to figure out like what is going on, and you know, that can happen. We're getting this vacuum about it. But I guess in my own experience, I'm like, it's really important to zoom back out.
Mm-hmm.
Not get too distracted from like the core lifestyle self-care rituals that are pretty key for, you know, putting pretty much anything into remission. It's what I think anyway these days.
Yeah, that's very much a Chinese medicine philosophical way of looking at it when we look at health and well-being.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, totally. That's why you see all the Chinese doing their Tai Chi. And, yeah, there's a whole ritual around health. And naturopathic medicine obviously has it as well, but I feel like the authentic Asian or Eastern medicines really integrate that. So, well said. Thank you so much, Stephen, for taking time out and joining us on the podcast today. I feel like you've given us so much information around histamine and histamine intolerance for someone that might have just heard about it or, you know, a practitioner that's going down the rabbit hole to learn about it. Where can our listeners find you and find some more information about the things you're offering?
Yeah, just my website, so stephenjudge.com.au. All my social media handles are Stephen Judge Naturopath. Posting all kinds of random interesting things on there pretty regularly.
Yeah, you do share a lot on the Instagram. That's how I found you. You've got a lot of good stuff on there related to the histamine. So good work with the sharing.
It's all about circadian rhythm at the moment.
Cool, yeah. Well, that's great, you know, like that's what we do. You focus on one thing and you share all the things and then you move on to the next and you integrate it all.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks so much once again, Stephen. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, and next time we'll get you back on to talk about circadian rhythms.
Thanks, Sandy.
Hey, guys. So since my last podcast, my website has changed to herearthmedicine.com. Here you can find me for my online appointments worldwide, my Wild Bloom online children's health course, and my upcoming Shoni Shin tools. Simply go to herearthmedicine.com.